What's up, folks? Crispin here with the Extra Crispy Podcast. We've got a great podcast episode lined up for you today with Dan Caro. Dan Caro is a drummer here in the New Orleans area. He's played with all kinds of people over the years. He's not just a great drummer, a fantastic human being with a very inspirational story. As a child, Dan Caro was burned over 80% of his body, lost both of his hands in the process, but went on to figure out a way to play the drums and just has such an inspirational story, which is great to hear, particularly this time of the year with Thanksgiving happening and the holidays. Just a super cool story and a very fun interview. I've enjoyed working with Dan Caro over the last couple of years, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But before we do, I announced on the last podcast that I just started a Patreon page for the Extra Crispy Podcast. So if you enjoy all these different conversations that I've been having over the last 2 years with authors and food critics and indie filmmakers and songwriters and musicians, if you've enjoyed these and you find them valuable, you find them helpful, you find them inspirational, and you believe in what we're doing, then consider going over to patreon.com, patreon.com, and search for Extra Crispy Podcast, and you can help continue to make this podcast possible. There's a lot of work that goes into every one of these episodes, from research to interviews to recording, engineering to editing and posting all this stuff, not to mention the equipment that it takes to do this. I've invested thousands of dollars in this podcast over the last couple of years, and it has been a labor of love, and I love to do it, but I'm looking at doing this podcast on a more regular basis, improving the quality, continuing to improve in the quality as well as the quantity, to have episodes coming out every week, or maybe even more than once a week, if I can get there. But you can help make this possible by going to patreon.com, the Extra Crispy Podcast, and you can support this podcast for as little as $5 a month. $5, less than the cost of one of those fancy drinks you get over at Starbucks. And if just a handful of you out there can do this, it can really help me continue to do this. So go over to Patreon and support Extra Crispy. And for now, we are going to go into this fantastic episode with Dan Caro, drummer, inspirational speaker, author of The Gift of Fire, How I Made Adversity Work for Me. Thanks for listening to Extra Crispy. Now to this Extra Crispy conversation. Well, here I am with Dan Caro, and Dan, you got quite an interesting story. I think I met you for the first time a couple of years ago when we played the U2-Carist. And I remember I was interviewing Father Bill, and we ended up talking about that. And then he said, "Can you play at the church with the band that we've got?" And I said, "Sure." And he's like, "You know, we got this guy Matt Limler on piano, and then we got this guy Dan Caro, who has no hands and he plays the drums." I'm like, "What?" And then when we played the thing, I was just blown away by how well you played, but more than that, over the last couple of years, I've just appreciated, like, you just got such a joy and I love just what you bring to the music, because there's, you know, I play with people who are amazing musicians who are not fun to play with. They're just jerks.
Yeah, no doubt. Me too.
But I'd love to hear your story today. Just about how because you've written a book called The Gift of Fire, How I Make Adversity Work for Me, And I think the listeners of this podcast would just be fascinated to hear some of your story. So just maybe just tell us some of your story here today.
Sure, appreciate it. And just to recap, thank you for those kind words. It's been a pleasure getting to play with you. And I totally know what you mean about working with great musicians who might not be great to work with.
Yes.
You know, so you're not one of those great musicians that aren't great to work with. You're easy and fun to work with. So thank you. And I'm glad that we had this opportunity.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was born in Metairie back in 79, and then my parents immediately moved to the West Bank. They got a house down there, and it was pretty good stuff for the Caro family for a little while. My dad was an insurance agent, and life was good. I had two older brothers. My mom was kind of taking care of the kids and doing that stuff. And then one day, on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day in 1982, I was 2 years old, and everything changed. So I walked into the garage of the family home. My mom and I were home that day. It was a school day, so my two older brothers were at school, and my dad was off to work. And I managed to escape my mom's supervision. Ended up in the garage, knocked a can of gasoline over, and we had a water heater with a pilot light. And when pilot ignited the vapor, I was trapped in a flash fire explosion. And that was basically the event that kind of changed my life for sure, and changed our whole family's life. And you know, that's the moment that has brought me to this point in time, right here and now.
Wow.
So over the next many years, thank God for strangers' generosity. And the community that we were part of was very supportive, and my family was very supportive. I was able to have a shot at life. You know, there's an organization, a hospital network called the Shriners Hospitals for Children, and they took me in, initially the one in Boston. And I was there for off and on for about 10 years. Surgery after surgery after surgery after surgery, reconstructive surgery, plastic surgery. And then eventually I was transferred to the Boston, or to the Galveston Shriners branch, and then continued there for another 10 years or so.
Wow.
Just surgery after surgery. And, you know, 80-ish surgeries, maybe a few more.
Dang.
But that's a lot, you know. And my whole childhood was kind of in a hospital gown, which those things suck. But, you know, as difficult as it was, Crispin, it was still thrilling and exciting. I mean, I was still a child.
Yeah.
I still had older brothers who were competitive with me, who weren't going to let up on me. I was still very, very much integrated into the schools that I went to. My peers were very supportive. Yeah, they were a little kid friendly around me, but or a little delicate around me at times, but I forced them to be more tough with me. And you know, just I'm a little bit competitive by nature, so and I want to be on the level. I want to be on par with everyone else. So if they were playing tackle football, so was I. If they were going up for a rebound and getting an elbow in the face playing basketball, that was probably going to be my elbow in the face. So it didn't matter. You know, I mean, I have some issues. You know, I was burned over 80% of my body, third and fourth degree burns, lost my hands and fingers, toes on the left foot. I have major orthopedic issues with bone development in the legs and in the spine and the back. It's just, I'm still able to pretty much perform 96% of every function that you can.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's an amazing thing. Just, I couldn't believe it till I saw it, because like when it comes to playing drums, you strap the drumsticks on, like, I mean, you set up your drums, everything. Like I'm thinking like, and not only that, you play well and with finesse.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. That took a long time to refine, and I'm still working on it even like almost 30 years later, but no, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's just something, life is something that I love doing. You know, when you're faced with that sort of adversity and that trauma where you know that it can be ripped away from you in an instant, like you've got to live every second like it's the last. I mean, you've got to love it. And if you don't love it, then, well, you're going to have a tough one. You're going to have a tough go at things. And I've always loved it. So it wasn't that challenging. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of perspective, right? So when I look back on it, I'm like, man, this life kicked butt, you know? Yeah. I mean, I loved every second of it. I wouldn't trade a day of it, you know, that's for sure. I wouldn't trade a day.
So what? Why do you think, because I've seen sometimes people go through some massive, horrible tragedy in their life and they don't go, they get bitter, they just, it collapses them in on themselves. I think certainly from the outside, thinking of going through something that tragic and that, I mean, especially, I didn't know how old you were when that happened, but man, 2 years old. What do you think helped you actually come out of that and be able to engage and be able to be positive?
Well, you know, I had a great family support system. You know, that was the number one thing. I mean, for sure, just the immediate environment around me was so safe and friendly, you know, and then I could always seek refuge in the family, in the house, or with the extended family. And I even considered the community part of that family, right? Yeah. The neighborhood that I was in. We were all very much looking out for one another. And obviously, because of my delicate situation, I think they were looking out for me a little bit more. So, you know, so that's sort of my immediate perceptible, reason for my attitude and the way I navigated. And then we grew up Catholic and very strong in faith. And, so that there's always been that spiritual element, you know, that's sort of the underlying and overlying theme that just circles us. And we can feel that love and that energy, kind of emanating from everything that we see and touch and experience, you know? So, that's just the undertone of life is just the faith and belief that there's a higher being out there that's looking out for us in some way or another. And then, meeting other folks along the journey who've experienced other types of adversities or similar adversities as myself, and hearing their story, hearing how they've overcome their challenges. And listen, you know, I have my dark days too.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, we all do. I mean, I've been bitter, you know, but I didn't stay bitter.
Yeah.
You know, that's the challenge. When you experience some massive trauma or some calamity that just will destroy your mental ability to see any light anymore. I mean, that's when things are real bad. And if you can figure a way out of that, come back to the surface and live again, you know, that's sacred, man. That's a gift. And I've been able to do that many times throughout my journey. And, so hopefully some of these experiences that I've been able to have, and the way I talk about them and the way I play music, it's hopefully exuding this enthusiasm and this passion for living, hopefully some of that will inspire other folks to not take life so seriously and not get so caught up in the details that can wear you down. You know, you got to deal with all that stuff. Everybody's got their problems. Everybody's got bills and challenges. But to live in that mind all the time, that's a negative way to do it. You're gonna destroy any creative processes you've got, any possibility for genuine happiness. And I don't want to live like that.
Yeah.
I want to be happy. I want to be, you know, on stage having fun, playing music with you and other folks, man. It's great. You know, we don't have time to be sad and miserable. You know, wake up, people. Come on.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like you must have had a mindset just from early on of just not accepting the limitations that would get in your way. It seemed like when did you decide you wanted to start playing drums?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I grew up in New Orleans, in and around New Orleans. I mean, come on, how can you not be a drummer? I mean, you know, you got a keyboard, you play guitar, and you sing, but you're a drummer too. I know you are, you know? Everybody's a drummer, you know, they just don't know it. But, you know, my dad played music.
Really?
My paternal grandparents were both musicians. I didn't really know them.
Was your dad a drummer? Or?
No, he's a trumpet player.
Trumpet player, okay.
My grandfather was a trumpet player. Okay. And from what I heard, my grandmother on my father's side was a great singer, but I never met her. And then my two older brothers both play brass too, trumpet and trombone. So it was in the house.
Yeah.
And it was on the street. I mean, with the parades and hearing those drums coming miles down the road, that spoke to me. It was the spiritual connection that I had. It was like, I didn't know what it was. And I'm a kid, but I'm feeling it, right? And every time that energy, it's just consuming me. And I just feel the need to participate in that. And I never danced. I never really was one of those kind of people that physically demonstrated the rhythm by your body motion. But I was in it. I was inside of the rhythm without knowing it. And I would always ask my dad, like, what those rhythms were. How does that happen? Like, I wanted to understand philosophically what it was all about. And I remember at like 6 or 7 years old, hearing a little motif or something on a commercial or TV show. I was like, what is that? That sounds really cool. And my dad would pat it out on my back. And he would try to explain to me what that rhythm was. And I didn't understand. I'm six. But I understood on a deeper level.
Yeah.
So throughout my whole childhood, I was attracted to the rhythm. But, you know, due to my physical situation, limitation, if you want to say that, we never explored it, you know. Plus, I had other things that I had to figure out how to do, like button a shirt and tie my shoelaces. I mean, that was really the biggest challenge in my whole life. And after a couple of victories, a couple of personal successes, around 12 years old, I felt confident enough to embark on the musical journey. And at that point, I think I was, you know, cognitively on a different level. I was ready to take on challenges that would last longer, would be more of a journey than something that you can immediately do. You know, I was ready to create a life decision that I was ready to stick with, that I was willing to go all the way with. And music was that. And we had a piano at the house, and I love piano. I would really love to be a pianist if I had fingers. But I just don't have the fingers, and you kind of need those. And I play a little now, but I've, you know, now that I know theory and stuff, I understand chord inversions, and you can omit certain chord tones and stuff, and you can arpeggiate. So I can play some stuff now, but at 12 years old, that didn't work. Yeah. So the only other option, because I don't have the ability to close my lips, so I can't create that, what do you call it, an embouchure?
Yeah.
I can't blow a horn, so that sucked because I couldn't follow in my family's footsteps.
Yeah.
But I could still play music, and I could still make a lot of noise, and I could still bug my mom every day, and I could hear her screaming still to shut up. But I picked the drums because it was something that I felt I could just strap on sticks and just figure it out, you know. And I think I did. I did a pretty good job initially developing the technique rather quickly. My dad and one of his old buddies, a guy named Glenn Desidu, a great drummer from old days in the 60s and 70s, and he still plays, but that was sort of his heyday. He was playing on Bourbon Street and really kind of made a name for himself back then. Well, he was willing to help me figure out a method to play and to teach me the basics of drumming. And it took about a month of trial and error, but we figured out the method that I currently use.
Wow.
And it hasn't changed much in 30 years. Excuse me. And what it is, it's very simple. It's like a tennis wristband, like a sweat band, right? And a couple rubber bands wrapped around it. And I use that on my right hand. Because I have a tiny reconstructed thumb that doesn't really work, so I can't grip anything there. So I need that only on the right hand. And then I insert the stick between the wrist and the wristband.
Yeah.
and I can grip with that. And then on my left hand, the Shriners doctors were able to reconstruct the thumb using bone grafting and all kinds of other procedural things over a course of several years to give me a moving thumb. And I gripped the stick with that thumb on the left hand. And, wow. You know, it's been about, it's like 27, 28-year journey now. So,
wow. Do you know of anybody else out there that plays, that has gone through a similar condition that has plays the drums like that?
Yes.
Really?
I have a twin. I do have a twin. I when I was living in New York after Katrina for a little while, I discovered this guy named Ray Levier. I think that's how you spell his L-E-V-I-E-R, I believe. And he's a burn survivor also. And he uses a similar technique, but he doesn't use the smoke band. He just uses rubber bands. I don't think he's burned as severely as I was. He's burned pretty severely, but he has more of his hands.
Gotcha.
So he can kind of use some of the hands to grip with, whereas I can't. And I'm not trying to one-up you, Ray. I love you. And you work with some great players. And he works with like Peter Bernstein and Mike Stern up in New York and stuff. And I'm like, what? I wonder if they mistake me for him and he for I. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's got to be some mistake there. But I ran into him, literally bumped into him. The first time I ever met him was at the NAMM show in Anaheim about 4 or 5 years ago. I can't remember. And, you know, we our backs were turned to each other and I kind of bumped into him. I'm like, look at this guy. We're twins. You know, hey, Ray, what's up? But yeah, it's funny. Like, but other than him, I'm not sure if there's any other cats who are burned as we are, but there are other folks who are have amputations or other abnormalities of their limbs that are playing. I know a guy out in, I believe he's in Australia. He runs an organization called Can Do Misos, which features musicians with disabilities, and he's a drummer. His name's Andrew Hewitt, and he's got cerebral palsy, and he plays. And I've taught a kid with cerebral palsy. I've taught a kid who is paralyzed, quadriplegic. Wow. We figured a way, and it worked. I mean, he wasn't fully paralyzed, but yeah. We figured a way to get him to play. He could only play like "We Will Rock You," you know, the boom boom, ka,
yeah.
boom boom. Mm-hmm. But so what?
Yeah,
he did it. And it's a hell of a story, but there are a few folks out there,
wow.
You know. And listen, man, like you've heard of that guy Tony Melendez, guitar player. He's from Mexico.
Oh,
he doesn't have arms.
Yeah, he plays with his feet.
Yeah, he's a brilliant singer. Oh, he's a brilliant guitar player.
Yeah,
you don't need arms. You don't need hands. You don't need fingers. If you want to play it, you're going to play.
They'll figure it
right?
out.
They got a drummer with no arms, and he plays with his feet too. He was on a commercial. Recently, I don't remember exactly, for the Grammys or for the Super Bowl, or maybe it was for the X Games. I can't remember exactly what it was. My memory about those details are weird, but he was like a big band type drummer, and he did this buzz roll with his feet kicking the band off, and
what?
He was the drummer for the band. And I'm like, whoa, there you go. So, you know, I'm not unique, and that's fine. And I'm glad I'm not unique.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love to see folks who have overcome tremendous challenges, excel in their life, and live their dreams. Yeah. Why not?
Wow. I got to imagine, you know, as a teenager, when you were learning how to do that, that probably was incredible, you know, to have that gift emerging in your life, not just the technicality of figuring out how to play the drums, but then what drums actually, how that could probably affect you too.
Oh, well, certainly. It was a great source of physical therapy. You know, it aided in my recovery, you know, my rehabilitation. So that was one obvious side effect of playing drums. Another thing was it put me in a different social setting, you know, because we play together. We're a community, right? It's great to play drums in your home, but it's way better to play drums with other people.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and when you start working with other people, you start talking to other people. Not that I was a recluse, you know, or
introvert.
Introvert. Yeah. Introvert. That's the word I'm looking for. But I wasn't bold. You know, I wasn't like I wasn't going to go and infiltrate a new social group. I was going to be invited into the new social group. But when I became a musician, and when I started working with other people, I started creating my own groups, started building that confidence, and started to have that my own community that I could invite people and sometimes kick people out. You know, not everybody belongs, man. You got to play nice, man. But no, it was great. So it helped me on that side too, and just and what music did for me also, it exposed me to cultural diversity. Mm. You know, I mean, it's not just a bunch of people who grew up in my neighborhood. You know, now I'm playing with folks from different countries and playing with folks who speak different languages, playing with folks of all ages, all different financial, spiritual persuasions, political affiliations. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
When we're playing music together, man, that's communion, you know, that's what it is. So that was something really like awakening for me, was just the understanding that, you know, no matter what differences we might have in you know, what we're facing in our personal lives, when we come together as musicians, you know, we do transcend all of that other stuff, and we become a unified group that is really magical. It can bring a lot of joy and inspiration to not only us, the participants, but everybody that we come into contact with. And fortunately, throughout my musical career, I've been able to take a lot of different groups on the road and experience people from all over North America. I haven't really toured much internationally, but just US and Canada.
Yeah.
But I've met so many people in the US and Canada who I would have never had the opportunity to meet if it weren't for music.
Yeah.
And now I do some keynote speaking also since I published the book. So so through both of those channels, I'm able to network and have wonderful contact and communication with folks that I would never have access to.
Wow.
So it's so wonderful, man. And like, you know, I say the music is like 10% of it, you know, that's like the minority percentage of what we do. I mean, it's so much bigger than music, you know? And, you know, I used to be one of those people that's music is life, man. Everything is music. And I'm like, no, it's not. Music is a part of it.
Yeah.
But man, there's so much else out there, you know?
Don't you know you're mine? Love's always worth talking about. Especially when they take it away. Mm-hmm. Girl, before you start walking now, say and change your mind, and you would give this thing one more try. Baby, I can be wrong, let me apologize. Put it down and move on, and we can call it life. What's it gonna take to get it, change your heart tonight? Don't you know? Put the claws back in.
Come on.
Stop playing, let your dog back in. You remember how it was back then? It was fun back then, it was love back then, mama. Where the hell did we go wrong? Hold on, baby, hold on. Now don't put your coat on. I was so wrong, the feeling was so strong. Now you tell me so long. Ooh, my baby let the cold in. Put my hand on the shoulder and it's frozen. Seems like just the other.
Well, the greatest gig I ever played was at Tipitina's in, I don't remember what, maybe it was 2000, 2001. And it was, or 2000, I don't remember, dates don't work for me. It was Michael, I was playing with Michael Ray and the Cosmic Crew, which was a phenomenal band, that's my favorite band I ever played with. Sorry, everybody else. It just kind of was. I mean, it was such a unique group of folks. We played space funk, cosmic stuff. So Michael has been one of the trumpet players for Kool & the Gang since the late 70s, but he was also one of the trumpet players for the Sun Ra Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And he's been doing that since the early 70s. And so it's kind of avant-garde Sun Ra stuff, but it was very funky and kind of New Orleansified, right? So it was like this hybrid of like straight-ahead jazz with avant-garde free stuff with kind of Kool & the Gang 70s R&B funk, but New Orleans-ish.
Yeah.
So it was phenomenal music.
And
a songbook that just, I mean, like, I, you know, you could, if we started playing a gig 10 years ago, we wouldn't have gotten through all the songs by now.
Wow.
You know, that's how many songs is in this book. So I apprenticed, the only gig I ever had to apprentice for. So the original drummer, Eddie Dejean, great drummer, I think his wife had gotten a gig in Germany, so he had to relocate. So they needed another drummer. And Michael was playing with me in another group, and he asked me to come and understudy with Eddie Dejean. And so for 6 months or so, we played every gig side by side. And Eddie had such command of the book. He knew everything. He knew all of Michael's gestures. He knew all the cues, every detail, all the shifts, time shifts. Because in avant-garde music, yeah, it sounds like it's disorganized and crazy, but it's not. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of cues and direction that you need to know. And Eddie hooked me to all that stuff. For about 6 months, we played together. And by the end of that 6 months, he moved away, and I became the drummer. And one of the first gigs was Michael's 50th birthday party. So it was a big celebration at Tipitina's. It was fantastic. It wasn't sold out, but it was a huge crowd.
Yeah.
Like over 500 people probably. And there was, I think, 14 of us on stage.
Oh, huge goodness.
Band. Lots of horns, dancers. And it's like kind of, if you've ever seen a Sun Ra performance,
yeah,
it was like that. We were all in those costumes, and it was great. And I'm so elated, but I'm nervous, and but everybody is so giving on that stage. And we were playing, and all of a sudden I noticed this low frequency resonance at the base of the stage, and it started at our feet. And it wasn't feedback. It wasn't feedback. We had reached something that caused a ripple in time and space. And slowly over the song, it kept rising, and then it hit our knees, and then it hit our thighs, and then it came up to our hips, and it consumed us. And
whoa.
I remember looking around during and after the song, and we kind of just let that go. We all acknowledged that something happened.
Wow.
On stage. Even my dad was in the audience, and he recognized something a little bit different that night than he had ever seen of us before. So I think that was the highest moment of musicality I've ever been part of.
Wow.
Nothing can come close to that.
Man.
So I don't, and then everything else, I mean, I've had lots and lots of great experiences, but that one.
I was reading this guy talking about the way our brains understand music. And I remember reading years ago, this guy, Oliver Sacks, a neuroscientist, was saying, you know, just to hear music involves about 16 different parts of your brain at once. You know, a lot of people think there's a part of your brain that has to do with music. And he's like, no, music has to do with all of your brain. And so if it takes 16 parts of your brain just to listen to music, it's exponentially much more when you actually start getting into it. And but this guy I was reading the other day was saying one of the reasons they think that music, you can listen to a song, a good recording, and have this experience, a fresh experience with that song over and over again, and you hear new things, is because so many parts of your brain are used at once in listening to music, it only allows your attention to kind of be drawn to different things. So every time you hear it, your brain is going to be interpreting those things in new ways. And so that's, you know, why you can hear one song hundreds of times and never get tired of it. And we've all got those songs. But I think even in terms of of playing music live, that there is that sense, kind of like what you talked about at Tipitina's, there is something about the rhythms and the melodies and the grooves, but probably even more so, I think, as far as the musicians, that when you can get into this place where you're not trying to perform, where you are freed of your ego and you are just letting it unfold, that is just magical. If everybody gets into that place at once, and then you have the audience that is caught up in that, it really is magical. And it is like there is something otherworldly, something in another realm that you tap into. And you can't make that stuff happen, but you can at least try to be more and more open and dial down a little bit. But I guess that's part of the constant frustration of being a musician, is trying to get into those spaces. You were talking about Johnny Vodakovich. And for those who are not from the New Orleans area, Johnny Vodakovich has probably been responsible for mentoring some of the best drummers that have emerged out of the area. But you said something about taking some lessons. Just share what you were sharing about learning from Johnny Vodakovich, sure. Particularly by watching him.
Yeah, sure. So I met Johnny when I was a student at Loyola, I think in 99, 2000, 2000 to 2001 or two. And he and I were, we talked a lot. We didn't play a lot of drums in our lessons. We talked more about like life and philosophy and just general stuff. And we drank coffee and drums was sort of a non-issue. And the one thing he did say, though, was when we first met, he asked me who my influences were and all that. And, I, you know, Tony Williams and Elvin Jones were my top two cats that I was really, really studying and trying to emulate. And Johnny said, well, that's your problem. He goes, you can't emulate those guys. You can never be those cats. Wow. So, you know, why don't you try being Dan Caro? I mean, like, you can always be him. No matter how you're feeling, you're going to be Dan Caro 100% of the time. So, yeah, it's fun to listen to those guys, and you'll get little things from them subliminally. You'll play stuff that you don't even know you're doing, but don't force it.
Yeah,
don't try to be those guys. And that was a very profound lesson, and I've taken that with me everywhere since then. And anytime I have the opportunity to teach anyone, I always bring that up, and I always cite Johnny for that, because that was something that I had never really considered, being my own self, having my own unique voice, which is silly. I mean, that's weird to think about, right? It's like we think, because we hear all these other drummers, and, you know, well, where did they come from, and where did those guys come from? And it just keeps going on and on. Well, where did you come from? You know, not musically. Where did you come from in life? You know, what is your life rhythm?
Yeah.
You know, what did that bully in school do to you that is going to create this energy under your playing, your this ferocity, this intensity? Maybe you're taking it out on the drum. Maybe you're having some therapy there, right?
Yeah.
So all of those things matter. You know, they can be applied to music. And that was a great lesson for me. Wow. And I try really hard to not cancel out the influences that I have, you know, Tony and Elvin and other great drummers. But I don't go after those licks and those fills and try to do that because that's what everybody else does. Yeah. I don't want to be like everybody else.
Right.
I want to be me, you know? And
the reason you like those guys is precisely because they're not everybody else.
Exactly. I mean, listen to Elvin. Listen to Tony. I mean, listen to Brian Blade. Those are my top three.
Yeah.
You know? And Johnny, you know, he's my mentor, right? He's a beautiful person, a beautiful musician, a beautiful drummer. You know, just what he was able to give me just in some brief coffee to chat, you know, was timeless. I mean, I'll take that with me forever.
Yeah.
And most of it had nothing to do with drums.
Right.
But it's made me a better musician and a better drummer. That's weird, right? Well, you know what? That's life. And when you open your life up, when you open your music up to your life, you channel what you've experienced, then you'll be better. And hopefully, you know, you won't be resistant to anything that comes your way. You won't fight when somebody redirects the energy on stage. You'll morph into whatever comes your way. Kind of like what I said at the beginning, we'll be like water for this podcast.
Right.
Wherever we go, that's where we're going to go. We're going to find the cracks, fill the holes. We're going to blaze new trails.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter because in I play a lot of improvisational music. And, you know, we work at the speed of thought, inspiration. So when it happens now, we have to go with that. We can't be thinking, oh, well, I wasn't going to go there. Well, that's not improvisation anymore.
Right, right.
You know, now you're in your head. Now you're playing something else.
Yeah.
Now your ego took over and you killed the show. You killed the energy.
Yeah.
And I can't stand that when I'm playing with musicians and we're so-called improvising and we're playing together as a community and having this so-called conversation that everybody talks about. And then everybody wants to direct the conversation their way.
Right.
You know, it's like a conversation's an organic thing.
It
goes where it goes.
Yeah.
We butt in. We have other thoughts. We have opposing views. Sometimes we all agree. Sometimes we don't. So that has to happen musically too.
Yeah.
And the greatest music I've ever heard happens that way.
Yeah.
But when I'm on stage and playing with cats that are looking at me because I answered their little statement.
Yeah.
Where I interjected my opinion on their theme, and I get that weird look. I want to knock those people off the stage, man. Come on, man. Let's have fun. Let's play. Yeah. Let's talk.
Yeah.
That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to talk.
That's good.
And that is good, man. When you're able to find cats who think like that and who play like that, that's where it really goes into another dimension. And you know, it inspires all of us on stage, but it inspires the audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm playing for me, but I'm playing for you too.
Yeah.
Right? And when we are able to transfer energy and transmit our feelings from the stage to the audience, and I'm able to feel their presence reciprocating back to me, that's when we really connected, and that's when everybody can go their separate ways and bring that enthusiasm out into the world and change things.
Yeah,
that's where it should be. That's a high level. It's another level. And we can all go there.
Yeah.
But we've got to step aside and allow it to happen. It's not going to happen because you make it happen. It's going to happen because you allow it to happen.
Well, and I think it's the, and I want you to maybe bring this back up. You said it a few minutes ago, you know, talking about Johnny Vidakovich and kind of time slowing down. But I do think there's this sense of, you know, so much of the struggle is learning how to get out of your analytical mind and to stop trying, you know, which sounds weird. I mean, I see so many young musicians, I mean, even my son, and I think this is part of it. You know, you watch you can get on YouTube and you can learn how to play anything, you know, find a tutorial telling you how to play like John Scofield or, you know, pick your person. But just because you can learn a solo the way somebody play it doesn't mean anything, because it's not, the magic's not the instrument and the magic's not even the notes. It is actually like what you're saying with Johnny. It's all that other stuff that, because really, by the time you get to the notes that are being played, that's a manifestation of something in that person's soul. And I don't care if you play the notes on the exact same guitar as John Scofield, and and you play, you know, you play the solo exactly the way he played it. It ain't gonna sound the same. There is that. I mean, practicing your instrument and being prepared, that is hugely important. But all that preparation is so you can get, out of your analytical mind and let the stuff come out. And I'm sure you know, I was talking with Brian Stoltz for the last podcast, and it's like when you get into that place, it's surprising what comes out. I mean, like sometimes when I can actually get in that, and I'm so bad at getting into that place. Mm-hmm. But when I do, like, I surprise myself, like, I didn't even know I knew how to play that, or like, yeah, right. That idea just comes forward. But it's an amazing thing. And I think the musicians that have inspired me, some of the most, as a keyboard player, I've really never been that much into piano players. I mean, I like piano players, but I've always been more into guitarists and drummers and stuff like that. And I find, you know, when I got to a few months back on my birthday, we went down and we saw the Miles Davis tribute that Matt Limmler was putting together that week. And I wanted to go because Brian Blade is one of my favorite musicians, and I never got a chance to catch him live. And I brought my wife and my two kids, my son Ezra, who's 16. I was just like, he's not a drummer, but I'm like, it don't matter. This is pure musical expression here. And we sat about six rows back from the front and got to see Brian Blade playing. And if you've never seen him play drums live, it's so crazy because he's just so expressive, and there's a soulfulness and beauty that just comes out of it that affects everything up there on stage. And like you're saying, it's getting this conversation moving along. And I remember when we were done that evening, like my son was just blown away. Like I could tell, like this is one of those experiences he's going to look back on 10 or 20 years later, just as one of the cool things that he got to experience when he was a formative musician. But I want to get back to something you said about, you talked about going to Snug Harbor and watching Vidakovich, and maybe you can share those thoughts, because I love what you had to say there, and I'm sorry that we lost it on a few minutes ago.
No, it's all good. It's all good. Johnny was, we didn't really talk a lot about drums during the so-called lessons that we had. We were just drinking coffee and chatting it up. But I went to see him, not at Snug. I mean, I saw him at Snug when he did his Astral Project gigs, but I went for his trio at the Maple Leaf and at the Old Point before that. He used to play, I think, Wednesdays at the Old Point in Algiers. So I was there for that and when he transitioned to the Maple Leaf. And I would sit or stand right at kind of behind him, almost like you know, the recorder man mic technique where you got the over-the-shoulder kind of mic? So that's a production thing. But I was that vantage. Kind of over his shoulder watching him, because I needed to see I didn't need to hear him necessarily. Yeah. I didn't care what he was playing. I mean, I did, but it wasn't important enough for me to analyze and critique his performance and want to, what do you call it, when you transcribe his performance like so many people do. And that's great, but yeah, whatever. Okay. I needed to feel it. I needed to see how he moved. I needed to see where he hit, how he twisted his wrist, you know, and how he popped off of that cymbal, and when he would crash into it, like how far into the cymbal did he go? You know, like martial artists.
Yeah.
Like when you watch the Bruce Lee, the 1-inch punch thing, you know, the 6-inch punch thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't end upon contact. That punch goes through.
Yeah.
That's why he had so much force to push his target, you know, 10, 15 feet backwards from a 1-inch or 6-inch distance. Can you imagine the power? Well, that's some of the things that I learned from Johnny, how to do the 1-inch punch through a drum, through a cymbal, how to get power beyond what what you have.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for volume, but for energy and intensity to dig through the drum to get a different tone.
Yeah.
To get a different reaction from the skin, from the bottom skin.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And it's like, oh, this is really transcendent stuff, right? Like, this isn't normal drumming. It doesn't matter what note you're playing. This is a feel thing.
Yeah.
It's a complete feel thing. And going back to Brian, he's the exact same.
Yeah.
And Brian takes it to a level where it's like, he's not even a drummer.
No.
Like, Brian's not even a drummer.
Yeah.
In my book, Brian is something totally different. He's another whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay? And yeah, he just uses drums and cymbals to facilitate his voice, but that is not drumming. Yeah. It's a whole other level. And Johnny and him and the way Stanton gets inside of his drums and digs into that snare drum and his cymbal playing, it's like, man, this is a whole other level stuff. And that's what I wanted from Johnny. And I didn't know how to ask those questions. Yeah. I'm not even sure if I knew what I was doing while I was watching him.
Yeah.
But those are the things that I picked up on. And I also noticed in watching Johnny's performances, like when he was at his best, he was kind of like able to slow down time.
Yeah.
In a way, so he can manipulate the rhythm and the groove in on a such a sophisticated and refined level that you couldn't do it and you couldn't even perceive it in real time. But you noticed, like, Johnny was able to get inside the note and push it or pull it or lift it or sink it in a way that really took some kind of deeper level of opening your mind to allow the rhythm to dictate kind of more of the focus instead of you trying to dictate the rhythm.
Yeah, yeah.
So the rhythm is going to dictate you, right? And that happens by reaction, response, and playing with your musicians on the stage, but not just to those folks, playing to the stage and the speakers on the stage and the floor underneath you, and playing to your blood pressure, playing to the audience's reaction, playing to the noises of the beer bottles, because we're all in clubs usually, playing to the beer bottles going in a garbage can.
Yeah.
You know, those things are going to dictate more than what you should be dictating.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned a lot about getting out of your way, you know, and allowing the music to go where it wants to go. Yeah, we're all good musicians. We all put in ridiculous amounts of effort and energy into our practice. But yeah, we don't want to hear all that nonsense. You know, we don't want to hear you playing Eric Dolphy licks or Joe Pass licks or Wes Montgomery or Thelonious Monk. We want to hear who you are.
Do your thing.
Play you, you know? I mean, who cares if it's the greatest thing in the world?
Yeah.
But it's your thing.
Yeah.
That's the greatest thing in the world because it's your thing.
Yeah.
Like, period. That's all.
And I think really when you can do your thing, that is getting out of your ego and out of the analytical mind, because you're not trying to be something you're not. You're actually open to that moment, because that analytical stuff just it shuts down the groove, it shuts down the emotion, it shuts down the soul. And there is this, because music is a weird thing. It requires focus, but it also requires letting go, which it's this tension between focusing on what you're doing but not focusing, you know. And
well, you got to trust that all the work you've put in since you were a kid till today. You know, I just turned 40 this past weekend. I don't know how old you are, but
47.
Okay, so we put a lot of time in this.
Yeah,
we have to trust that all that effort is going to give us enough confidence to let go.
Yeah.
That even if we can't, we're not inspired at that moment to say something that we have enough facility to keep the song going and without disruption and to play rock solid grooves and rock solid parts. And then maybe that magical moment might come in later. But yeah, if you're so focused on trying to dictate where this has got to be and that's got to be and where she's got to go and he's got to go and you came in a bar early or something like that, yeah that kind of sucks. But you know what? It happened. You better go with it, okay? Because you can't stop and you start over. Unfortunately, I was in a band once and we actually did that. We were playing at the Jazz National Park. I don't even know what the official name is.
Oh, yeah, down in New Orleans.
Yeah. And it was just a Saturday concert, and all of a sudden, Secret Service walks in the door. We're like, what? And they like start examining the building and all that stuff. And then it's showtime, and we have Downbeat, and our former president, Jimmy Carter, walks in with his wife, Rosalyn. And we're like, what's going on? So the band leader, I think, got a little nervous, and we were playing a song and it kind of wasn't gelling. You know, we were just sort of establishing a groove, which is a vamp, right? But it was going to come together.
Yeah.
But this cat wasn't feeling it. So he stopped it and he apologized. Says, all right, sorry about this, guys. We don't normally do this, but, you know, we feel like we've got to do it right today. And he started us over. And I said, man, you totally killed it. It might not have been what we had worked on in the past, but it was going somewhere else. And we were good enough musicians to go with it.
Yeah.
And we could have gotten out of it back into where we knew, but we were going to ride this new wave for a little while.
Yeah.
And I think that he, at the time, he got a little analytical.
Sure.
A little too in his head, and he disrupted the flow.
Having a president walk in, that'll do it.
Well, I think that's the reason. It was a little nerve-wracking, you know. But the thing is, look, it doesn't matter what your distractions are. It doesn't matter, man, you know? Life's full of distractions, but you got to keep living.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got to keep moving forward, right? Otherwise, man, ain't no reason to get out of bed.
As far as you and your life right now, talking about getting out of bed in the morning, what is it that gets you out of the bed in the morning? What is it that you love the most, you know, in these... You just turned 40. Say this next decade, if you could, if money was no option or hindrance, you could pour your life into doing something, what would that be?
Yeah. So I've been thinking a lot about that. You know, as I get older, I'm like, I'm starting to feel the drumming taking a toll.
Yeah.
On the body a little bit, you know, because I do work a lot. Yeah. I'm gigging down on Bergman or Frenchman Street most nights, and sometimes working really long hours, not a lot of breaks. Poor PA situations where you're having to hit hard, and in the position that I play, it's a little bad for my knees and my back. So I'm kind of feeling some of that now, and I'm like, it's not bad. It's not debilitating. But I'm feeling it, and I never felt it before. And I'm like, I'm starting to think about how much longer can I keep going at the pace that I'm moving. And I'm not sure. I mean, like maybe another 15, 20 years. But, and that's, you know, that'll carry me through 55, 60 if I make it that long, if I'm fortunate to get there. But what after that, you know? And being a musician, you know, I said, you said money is no hindrance. Well, we don't make a lot of money as musicians. It's kind of like a money. I thought you were loved playing. Why don't you do it for free? So you know, but you know, trying to play along here. After I wrote my book, man, I started doing keynote speaking.
When did the book come out, by the way?
Oh, it's old. It's 10 years old.
Okay.
So I've been speaking for 10 years now, and it's a lot easier on the body. Oh, yeah. You get up and talk for an hour, and I play on the gig. Every talk that I do, I have a kit next to me, and I give them a little show at the end. You know, it's usually just me, but it's all good. I get to play, and everybody loves it. I mean, when I bring the drums as the conclusion, man, people go crazy over it. It's fantastic. And, you know, I've spoken to corporations, big public seminars and stadiums, schools, colleges, high schools, middle schools, nonprofits, medical industry things, and it's just such a different experience than playing music in clubs.
Yeah.
And they're both equally awesome. Yeah. Okay, that's the one thing I need to make clear. They're both equally awesome. Yeah. All right, but there is a very significant difference on the speaking side. Usually nobody's drunk. That's a huge one. So people are actually listening to you. They're there to see you.
Yeah.
They're there to be inspired and to listen and to learn and to be part of that community and help each other. That's what I love about those events, is it's so uplifting. Yeah. From the moment I walk out on stage till the moment I go to my hotel at night, because it's usually traveling. Yeah. Like it's not a lot of local gigs. But I'm meeting people. I'm hearing phenomenal stories, sometimes very sad stories, but people are opening up, and they're looking for something beyond,
yeah,
you know, something to grasp onto. They're looking for hope, and they're looking for advice and guidance. And I'm not qualified really to counsel anyone, but I think in a way, regardless of your certifications in the medical field or in the psychological fields and whatever, we're all qualified to give our perspective.
Absolutely.
Right? And I always tell them that I don't have any certificates or whatever, but here's what I've learned. You know, here's what I've been through. And maybe that can help get you through this and stay in touch. And I always give out contact info for people to reach me. I love the interaction.
Yeah.
I don't get that with the audiences and that I play with for when I'm working in clubs. We might have an exchange at the end of the night or on a set break, but that's where it ends.
Yeah, yeah.
And I walk away and they walk away. And maybe they'll go say, hey, you'll never guess what we saw. This drummer, no hands. He's great. Okay. That's wonderful, and I'm glad that they do that, and I'm glad that they found that inspiration. But when I can stay in touch with folks afterward and come back and visit them a year later or 2 years later and hear their news stories and hear how they've come along and evolved, and they hear how I've come along and evolved as well, that's another level for me. And, you know, it's not better than the music side, but it's different. And if I had no issues with money and I could do whatever I wanted to, and by the way, the speaking pays a whole lot more than the music does. So I wouldn't have money issues.
Yeah.
But no, if I could just go on the road and speak full time, that would be fantastic. And then I would also use the downtime that I have between gigs to go to different towns and network with musicians and play gigs, you know, because I know a lot of folks throughout the US and Canada who I could probably call up and say, hey, I'm going to be in San Diego, you know, in a week. Let's get together and play. If you got a gig, let's book a gig or 2 months from now or whatever, you know. That's what I really like to do, you know, just sort of live on the road and just come home whenever I want to, because I'll always base out of New Orleans, I guess, or the region. But I love traveling, man. Seeing places is wonderful.
Oh, I agree.
What about you?
What about me? Well, you know, I kind of do the same thing. I do a lot of speaking and a lot of music. So, I think... I'm trying to figure that out right now myself as I'm kind of stepping down from one thing and got some open possibilities in the future. Just the future is wide open. But yeah, I agree. I think that's kind of the weird thing for me, because I love speaking and I love playing music. And there's certain things like I want to say with music and certain things that, you know, I love being able to... I think the sad thing for me in this world is that music is so not valued, at least monetarily. Like everybody loves music.
Right.
I don't think people really recognize the power of it and are willing to, you know, it's sad that we live in a world where, like, I mean, particularly New Orleans, where some of the greatest music that has come into the world has its roots down here. And yet, I don't think most people recognize the gift that it is to the world, to humanity, and how much we need what music offers, you know, just the power of music, just like what we've said, just in bringing people together and getting people out of their own egos and minds. So I wish that there were some ways where, you know, you could, where it was more financially viable to do music, you know.
We need big pharma to market musicians.
That's right. That's right.
And then we'll be all rich.
Yeah.
Because they get a lot of money for their goodness. Drugs.
Yeah. My son Ezra, I think I shared this on one of the other podcasts, but he started playing with this group, Baby and the Brass Hearts, and he's playing with a couple other bands, but he's playing tuba in them, and a couple of months ago, he started making money playing music for the first time. And he comes home, and like in one weekend, he played a couple gigs, came home with $200. He's like, "Dad, I made $200. I was like, "So proud of you, son." But, you know, my first gig I ever got paid for, I was 17, 18, and I got $100. And I'm still playing still gigs making, where I get $100. And it's, and that's sad, you know, that's sad. Like everything else in the world has inflated, yeah. but, you know, that I still am getting gigs occasionally where I'm making, you know, I'm trying not to do gigs for $100, but you know, I still play them. But I love speaking too. And I love being able to communicate and get better at that and share with people and help them open up to the best in life and maybe different ways of living. But I think it's both things, but, if somebody wanted to bring you in to speak and, you know, how do they get in contact with you?
Well, I'm all over social media. I got Facebook pages.
Dan Caro.
Dan Caro, yeah.
Okay. Caro, is that the way you say
well,
it?
Well, you can say it however you want.
Okay.
Caro, Caro.
Caro, Caro, potato, potato. Caro,
whatever. D-A-N-C-A-R-O. And I've got Instagram and I think two Facebook pages. I've got an actual page. And then like a personal profile. So either one of those is okay. Accessible. About to start kind of getting a YouTube presence. I don't really have one yet, but I just had a meeting with Stanton Moore over lunch a couple of weeks ago. And he's trying to build his YouTube presence because something that he's neglected, even though he's got visibility all over the world for every other thing, he just neglected a YouTube.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, come on, man. He goes, maybe we can help each other. So he inspired me to get my YouTube up and running. So I'm going to do that as well. So eventually you'll see more videos on that. But also email contact. At dancaro.com, contact@dancaro.com. That's a way to get through to me through email as well. And directed at you, Crispin. Yeah, man, if you want to speak and play music, man, I want to do that too. So maybe we can figure out a way to do a joint project.
Maybe.
And do a co-speaking and co-music.
It started right here, folks. Hey. This was the inception. Yeah. No.
Why not? I mean, you want to do it? I want to do it. I live literally 2 miles from you. You know?
Why haven't we come up with that before?
I don't know. Well, we didn't really know that much that side. So, but yeah, anyway, I'd be down for it if you
would. I think that's, you know, that's the interesting thing too. You know, I think just even what we've talked about with music, you know, when you play, and I think this is one of the things I learned from music, you know, like when you're playing improvisational music, you're playing with other people, you're trying to stay open to the possibilities. But I think that's just the wonderful thing I see in life. When you can learn to live life that way, like just even the connections like we've made and just different people that God, you know, brings into your life and you can make yourself crazy trying to make everything happen, or you can learn how to stay open and receive the gifts as they come. And I think that's a better way to live. And it maybe deals with the ego a little bit better, but, yeah, you know, I think that would be cool. So yeah,
let's figure it out.
And you got a book. I got a copy here. It's going to have to sign here in a minute. Dan Caro, The Gift of Fire, How I Made Adversity Work for Me. And, I just got the book today. So But I just know from hearing your story even today and working with you, this is a great story that'll help a lot of people. Is this on Amazon or anything like that? Or,
it is. It's okay. on Amazon in all formats, I think.
In all formats. Okay, cool.
I think so.
Yeah. You got audiobook too?
Not the audiobook.
We need to work on getting you an audiobook.
Yeah, I don't have an audiobook. I should totally do that.
You should.
I could do it at my house. I have a studio.
I know.
I could totally do it. But
come on.
I got to authorize it happen. Through my publisher. We'll okay. see.
So Dan Caro, The Gift of Fire, a really inspirational story. And really, if there's anybody out there listening that you want to get Dan in to speak, he's got so much to offer and really is just a great example of a fine human being who has overcome a lot and a hell of a drummer too. Oh, so
thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming over to Extra Crispy Studios today, Dan. I've really enjoyed getting to talk with you today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Appreciate right. you.
Well, that concludes this episode of Extra Crispy. And you might have noticed at one point it sounded about halfway through, 30 minutes into this episode, like part of what Dan was saying got cut off. And that was because my computer got all freaky. And so we recorded again for another 15 minutes and then it freaked out again. So we lost a chunk. So that was just the little blip in the episode. And I didn't say that on the front side. But anyway, it was great having Dan Caro in. And I'm sorry, I kept mispronouncing his name, calling him Caro. Dan Caro. My apologies, Dan. Really good conversation. And go check out his book. And if you get a chance to hear Dan live playing around the area, he is a fantastic drummer. I've enjoyed every time I've gotten to work with him. Don't forget to go visit Extra Crispy on iTunes, give us a review, give us 5 stars, a little few words about how much you like it. Share this episode with other people you think might dig it. And visit Patreon.com/Extra Crispy Podcast and become a patron of this program. Help keep making this podcast possible. And until then, have a happy Thanksgiving. And I'll be back in another week with some more episodes. One of the episodes we got coming up is the band Silicon Boone, which is a former Amish guy who just released a concept album about space. I hope that gets you interested. It's going to be fun. Until next time, may all your Thanksgiving conversations be extra crispy. Thanks for listening.